sustainable model. They are in provinces and as a result, I felt I try and do that. Now, you may recall that we have on our provisional program that you that's with you the 14th earmark for the oral hearings in the JSC. Now, I yesterday stopped Mr. DC from sending out those invitations because of this glitch now with the select committee, and we're hoping that they can then come on the 14th at this stage. What we'll then have to do is to take those public hearings and postpone those ones for a day or two next week. But I won't do that formally until we hear from the select committee one way or another, whether some people are going to be in attendance. So by Friday or so, we should have some sense of whether we are proceeding with the MPOC on Tuesday the 14th, or whether we're going to have the oral hearings on the JOC. So members will be informed of any changes in that regard. I expect there to be some. So please just bear that in mind. I really think that we need to finalize at least the briefing and some deliberations on the 13th Amendment as soon as possible, given that it is a priority vote and it can be followed by the other questions with the changes in the legislature and the Eastern State legislature. That's one of the concerns that they have, is that when we send those bills to them, they're not given adequate time to proceed adequately with public hearing and so on. So they're very keen that that bill goes to them as soon as possible. And I'm very keen that we try and expedite it. I've said to you that that's a priority bill, so we will shift around our program to accommodate it as soon as we get some cooperation from the select committee. I realize that they had planned these trips a while ago, but not like this is being fun on me. Gosh, it's too blue. So, but those are my problems, they're not your problems. I will deal with them as best I can. So, you'll hear from either Mr. BC or myself, hopefully before Friday, as to what we're going to do next week.
Can I just clear up something?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is the same one. Sorry, Dr.
Are you referring to me that I was scoffing and you said it was sent out with that on food bite?
I'm starting to fly economy. But you know, these people in the department, you never know what's going on.
I'm finding difficult to join the flight.
No, we did say we're not meeting on Friday, but we were meant to meet tomorrow, and now we're not meeting tomorrow. It's the long and short of the story. No. I can't see the select committee being available on the Friday, and they can't be available on the Wednesday. And given that it's a long weekend, I doubt that anybody's going to be around. No, I think we'll finish with the summaries today. We should be able to finish with the summaries today. They've got some instructions already to look at some drafts and so on, and that will keep them busy until next week. And then we will see them sometime next week, depending on how we're shuffling the 13th Amendment, the JSC, and the judicial education oral hearings, summaries of those, and deliberations on those as well. Okay, wonderful. Just give me a minute.
were on page 7, mm-hmm. and we have to start, we're still in clause 1, and we have to start to suppress the committee of KPI for information. There will be a lot of repetition on clause 1, since we stopped last week after very in-depth deliberations on clause 1, but I will go through them. The Practice Committee of the High Court, their first submission deals again with the issue of the committee is opposed to the proposed extension of the jurisdiction of the regional court, and their submission in this regard is based on the hierarchy of court argument that we listened to last week as well, where they say that the lower court, nothing has happened to eliminate the decree's disparity or to reduce the risk of an error leading to injustice. And the argument that life imprisonment remains the ultimate sentence in our law, and their view, and in their view, the currency of the sentencing would be debased if sentences of life imprisonment were to be imposed by what is still described as lower courts. The second point made by the Practice Committee relates to subsection 3AA, those grounds that we're excluding from substantially compelling. They are opposed to this provision, and they base this on Isus Mochat. They say the proposed amendment will extend against this process of interpretation should particular factors now be identified by the legislature and excluded in advance from the inquiry. They also warn that there might be a knee-jerk legislative reaction to these provisions, since some affected parties may want to add or subtract from the grounds that we have listed.
Yes, I went to bed with his really battling with this, and I tried to read whatever I could lay my hand on. I have this nagging problem on the I know there are many cases that dealt with it by the Constitutional Court as well, or some cases. The fine line between legislating and prescribing and interfering with the role of the judiciary. And I think you cannot divorce the relationship between the accused and the complainant and the personal circumstances of the accused. And it's a very fundamental thing that in sentencing, the court must take into account all factors regarding the or in regard to an accused. And I've got a very serious worry that we're going, we just on that line or crossing that line. Apart from the practical issues raised by one of the people that we listened to, you know, about the complainant rather than not wanting a very serious sentence, but wanting a little bit of her revenge, which is natural and understandable and which we agree to, and I once again say I have no sympathy with the rapists. But I think there is a rape and a rape. There are brutal rapes and gang rapes and all that. That surely is different from where a person had a long relationship, for instance, if we take the extreme, and that relationship is then broken up and then he rapes the person with whom he had that long. Or for that matter, between husband and wife. Well, no, I wouldn't. I have no sympathy there. But that is for the court to decide. In all the circumstances, where you would say I'm taking this into account or not, and unless we accept that our court is at the very least a reasonable instrument to bring about justice, unless we say that's not true, then I think we must be better to leave that discretion to the court.
Lines of the court when considering the circumstances around whether substantial and compelling circumstances exist, may not take these factors into account only. In other words, on their own, there must be a broader consideration, but on their own, these factors don't amount to substantive and compelling circumstances. Then the argument around the entire circumstance, I think you're also arguing very much what Professor Blanche is arguing in his submission on the issue of, he says that the court doesn't take one issue and find that there is substantial and compelling circumstances. It's a range of issues that it must find before it can pronounce on whether there are substantive and compelling circumstances. And I think Marcus is very much along those lines as well. So if we were to say that, if we were to word it in that way, and I think you know what I'm saying now, that you can't solely find that there are substantial and compelling circumstances that exist on these individual matters. So if they exist, that in and of itself is not a substantial and compelling circumstance. So then you don't completely remove the consideration of those factors as part of the various circumstances and attributes that may or may not exist in a certain situation. but that you what you're doing is you're trying to perhaps further narrow the discretion to guide rather than prescribe. They hopefully will have a draft the next time we come here, and then we can further deliberate on that particular matter, because it is of concern to, I think, all of us, and we need to obviously be careful about how we phrase it, but bearing in mind, of course, that there are strong feelings about these factors, particularly when it comes to children and so on.
Chair, shall I continue?
Please.
Well, in point three, the Practice Committee welcomes the repeal of Section 51.4 and the amendment of Section 51.5. 51.4 deals with the executive now take into account sentencing from the time the person was away from trial, and 51.5 is the suspension of sentence, which we got instructions from.
But we're changing that to 51.5, eh?
Yeah.
Okay.
But if
you want the suspension, then we have to report the letter for my reason is incorrect.
Which?
5B.
Subject 5A or 5B? Oh, no, 5B, yeah. 5B goes.
What means that we include it?
No, we're not going to go there. Remember, our discussion was that if you suspend the sentence, you can't say apply a minimum sentence to a court, because the court would have gone through the process of checking whether there are substantial and compelling circumstances that justify a deviation or a lesser sentence, right? If the court finds that there are no substantial and compelling circumstances, it then imposes a sentence which is your minimum sentence. You can't then say, no, but you can suspend half of that, because that is tantamount to a minimum sentence. So that part is done.
Chair, then the next submissions were made by Judge Bertelsmann from the CPC. Firstly, he submits that the abolition of the referral process is welcomed. Secondly, it is, however, further submitted that the proposed increase in the jurisdiction of the regional court is worrisome, since history has shown that every increase in the penal jurisdiction of the lower judiciary has resulted in all courts in the increase of sentences imposed.
It's not an increase in the penal jurisdiction of the lower courts. It's not a general increase in their sentencing jurisdiction. It's specific to part one. It's specific to the limited number of crimes that you find in this legislation.
In the third point made, it is further submitted that the current clogging of the High Court role by Section 52 referrals will be replaced by a significantly more severe bottleneck of appeals that will be launched as a matter of course against the imposition of life sentences in the regional courts. So it's the argument made last week as well about appeals.
Yeah. The truth of the matter is that may or may not be the case, but it's not going to... Ultimately, what you have now is a referral process, which is as problematic administratively, if not probably more cumbersome than an appeal would be, particularly when it comes to reopening cases and hearing witnesses again and so on.
With
appeals, you don't do that.
The appeals he's referring to are only the ones against the imposition of life and life.
And life
has pointed out within 7%.
You only have 7% of those cases, and in any case, those cases are all of the life sentences that were transferred. Remember, the regional court, the magistrate told us that they refer all of those cases to the High Court. So 7% of all of the cases. Now you're going to have the additional filtering of numbers on the basis that the prosecuting policy will be that you prosecute most of those cases in the High Court. And then whatever you do at the regional court, you then have the automatic appeal. So hopefully it will be even less than that percentage of percentage may be the same, but it's a lesser number of members.
Anybody wants to add anything? We've got the fourth point. They just submitted that they're against subsection 3AA, that they will further restrict the discretion of the judiciary.
Okay, we'll deal with that when you come with your draft again.
Point five, finally submitted that apart from welcoming the evolution of the referral process and the reintroduction of the ability to take time spent in custody while awaiting trial into account, that subsection 4, in imposing sentence, the rest of the proposals must be rejected.
As we do with the appeal.
Okay. Then the next submission was made by the CHPRI, the Penal Reform Initiative. And their point in relation to penal reform, basically, it is submitted that the bill will have a significant impact on the size of the prison population by effectively increasing the sentence jurisdiction of the regional court.
You're only doing this part one.
The second last submission in clause one is by the Child Justice Alliance. It is submitted that section 516A is unconstitutional and violates the South Africa's international obligation. 516A relates to the children. So this assertion is made relying on judicial interpretation of section 281G and 282 of the Bill of Rights, as well as the interpretations made in the context of the Child Justice Act applicable to South Africa's regional and international obligations. It is therefore submitted that no minimum sentence should be applicable to persons under 18 years. Okay, this is the issue flagged last week, really.
Yeah, sure.
Now, I just want to speak something here.
Yeah, I was over the weekend, I think sometime, in the company of the Brontë, which is here somewhere. And I must say, it's very interesting. The first, clearly, I think we must deal with this matter of last resort and the least possible time. Now, I was very interested in this case called Maquetsha, which seems to me has hit the nail on the head completely in terms of our intention when we passed this legislation, and indeed getting the balance right in terms of children's rights. The first very interesting issue is, of course, in that case, the court said that it is always a matter to consider when you're considering whether substantial and compelling circumstances exist or not. The age of the accused is always a factor. Whereas the approach in the Brontë seems to put an onus on the accused, which it says is an unnecessarily heavy burden to bear, to show that the age of the accused is indeed a substantial and compelling factor. Whereas, as I say, the difference in the other case, the Maquetsha case, is that the court says that clearly that the court is obliged to look at the age of the accused when considering substantial and compelling circumstances. So that it's not a burden on one or other of the parties to the matter. That is quite an interesting differential that is made, and I think that Maquetsha actually dealt with it in the way that we had always intended, because we'd always intended that the substantial and compelling circumstances would encompass the issue. issue of maturity, the issue of development, all of which are factors when you consider matters pertaining to accused who are young. So that was quite an interesting issue. And that was a decision of the full bench, which Grant then rejected, of course. Then it goes on to very interesting analysis about the Blau case. Now, in the Blau case, it seems that what happened there was that the court said, when it reads the wording, a very technical and very complicated argument, but when it reads the words in 3B, sub 3B of 51, and where the legislature says, if any court referred to decides to impose a prescribed sentence, in other words, where the wording is such that where the court decides to impose a minimum sentence, then the court, a minimum sentence in the case of a child between 16 and 18, then the court might obviously prefer reasons for it. Now, I've interpreted this very curiously to suggest that the court, therefore, has a discretion because of the word decide. So it says where the court decides to impose a minimum sentence means actually that the minimum sentence doesn't apply, and that the court has a discretion to apply it. Now, clearly, it was a very technical argument, certainly not one that was intended at the time that we promoted this legislation. What we had intended is what Makweta said, is that we wanted the courts to be absolutely sure, when it comes to this category of accused, that they have applied themselves completely and utterly to the concept of substantial and compelling circumstances, that they find no compelling and substantial circumstances to deviate in the case of minors between 18 and 16. Instead, what the court in Blau said was to say, well, you can impose the minimum sentences if you want to, but you don't have to, is what the legislature said. Completely absurd. We wouldn't. Why would you prefer minimum sentences or a mandatory framework and then say, well, the courts can decide whether or not they want to apply? It just doesn't make any sense. So I think what we're going to need to do is we're going to have to revert back to the Makweta kind of interpretation, which says that it can apply, because I think it falls squarely within the limitations of the Constitution. We're dealing with very, very serious crimes here, and there can't be other measures of last resort or factors that would affect that consideration, as was conceded in the public hearings as well. But when you're dealing with very serious, the most serious, in fact, of crime, what other route is there for the courts to consider? So that's what we need to revert back to it. And one of the things that I think we need to do there is that clause that has been so badly misinterpreted, I think must remain, but that we need to reword it to make sure that what we mean is what I'm saying, is that the courts are enjoined by the legislature to be absolutely sure, when they don't deviate from minimum sentences and applying it to accused persons between the ages of 16 and 18, that they have done so properly. So we still require the reasons, but certainly you reword it and you take out the word decides. And then I want us to also just look at the sub 6 as well. What is the rationale in terms of 6A and 6B? When you are under 16, part 1, part 2, and part 3 don't apply.
Under 16 never applies, not even.
Now, why is it that it says subsection 1, 2, 8, or B?
That's
C is not yet.
Yeah, so what we're trying to do here is, in one it says, because in C it's 18 and below, so it will never apply to anybody.
Oh, I see, that's
yeah, so it's covered, so it's never, no category. What we try to do is be more lenient to the lesser offenses.
No, but where does it say that? I'm not with you.
If you read, this section does not apply in respect of a person who is under the age of 18 years at the time of commission of an offense contemplated in subsection 2C. That means 2C, nobody under 18 it applies to. But then the other three, you can have application for us. Between, we want that to apply between six, above 16-year-olds. But none of these minimum things will ever apply to anybody below the age of 16.
You're reading sub 6 then, when you say the section that will not apply to a person who is under the age of 16. At the time of the commission of an offense contemplated in subsection 1, which is your part 1 essentially, or 2A or B. 2A is part 2 and B is part 3. So where does it exclude the person in part 4? Just remind me.
In B.
And you said 18 years at the time. Oh, I see. 18 years at the time of the commission of an offense contemplated. Because that would include 16 years old.
So it's only for the more serious offenses that we want minimum sentences to apply. If it's really serious.
Why should part 4 not apply to under 18? Let's see what part 4.
Part 4 is schedule 1. With the weapon.
What is Schedule 1?
Schedule 1 is treason, sedition, public violence, murder. But then it's murder, not the one covered. Actually, I should read it the way it is in the sense. Yeah, it's treason, sedition, public violence, culpable homicide, rape, but not the ones covered already in the schedule, indecent assault, but not the ones covered already, bestiality, robbery, but not the aggravated that's already.
But it's still with a gun.
Yes. Child stealing, assault when a dangerous wound is inflicted, arson, and the question was whether arson can be
committed with a gun.
Malicious injury to property, breaking or entering any premises without a common law or statutory provision, theft without a common law, receiving stolen property knowing it to have been stolen, fraud, and lastly forgery or uttering a forged document knowing it to have been forged, which you also cannot do with a gun. And then there's still offenses relating to coinage.
With a gun. Going to shoot coins. the public violence thing there.
There's public violence, yes, it's the third one.
With a gun. So gangsters shooting at each other in the middle of a residential area.
I'm not sure what the definition of public violence is.
It's the reason that you're wanting to exclude it. Would the reason be that there are just too many of them?
I was thinking at the time was to be more lenient in that category of offenders. They might be more better rehabilitation maybe, or to leave it within the court's discretion in those instances, it seems.
Members, anybody wants to talk about the six or indeed three D? We're going to leave that in. We're going to, of course, pick up the issue of the firearm story. Those matters we doesn't apply. What did we decide they were going to do?
To create a new Schedule 3 to this Act, and then to list there to subtract from Schedule 1 those that you can really commit with a firearm. And yes, to then just make a small amendment to the Schedule Part 4 of this stage to say, instead of Schedule 1, you just say refer to Schedule 3. And those would be...
So it would be all those offenses where it's still possible to commit them with a firearm.
Yes. That would be treason, sedition, public violence, robbery, circumstances other than those referred to in Part 2 or 3 of Schedule 2. Assault when it's dangerous, wounded and inflicted with a firearm in circumstances other than those referred to in Part 3 of the Schedule. Breaking or entering any premises, escaping from lawful custody. Those were the ones the department is checking.
I think what we're going to do is we're going to put a bracket
and kidnapping for you.
Put a bracket under B at this stage. Because if you're going to do that, if we're going to change. Really take out those lesser offenses. In other words, offenses that don't really have anything to do with violence. And your Part 4 is now going to read just those things that are really quite serious. I mean, all those crimes committed with a firearm.
True.
Yeah. You might want to then reconsider excluding people from that category because you've now shifted that category and taken out the lesser offenses, so to speak, and you'll be left with only very serious offenses. So put a bracket there and just put a little note that we must look at this in conjunction with what's happening with your schedule. Huh?
Okay. Then the
last submission on clause one. I don't know if that's the last on juveniles at this stage. Can I continue to the?
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. It's from the Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference. Their first submission, they welcomed the amendment to section 51.4, which is the sentence that shall be calculated from the date of sentence that we're deleting. The second submission in reference to section 51.6, again, this one we just looked at, read with the repeal of 51.3b. It is submitted that it makes it more likely that prescribed sentences, including life imprisonment, will be imposed on youthful offenders as young as 16. It is submitted that the younger the offender, the greater should the discretion of the court be to determine the sentence. Basically, they're arguing that 51.3b, as it currently stands, leaves the matter far more to the discretion of the court. So it's actually in line with what the committee now mooted, that 51.3b should not be deleted.
Changed. So that we don't have the interpretation that says you can whenever you feel like it, impose it or not.
If I may, maybe some clarity on 51.3b. Could you explain why it's framed in the way it is at the moment? The original thought or the original thinking was, since Brandt, we've accepted that Brandt now meant that there's a blanket exclusion of all under 18. And we thought then, well, we just might just as well align the legislation with that interpretation. That explains the fact that B is being repealed completely. Then the second thought developed, said, no, but is that really? Because we have no doubt in our mind that that was not the legislative intention at the time. And it's probably not the correct way of going about it by simply aligning this with what we think is a wrong interpretation. So firstly, that explained why B was repealed. Then secondly, it was called to retain. In other words, then, because much remember, as it stands at the moment, there is a blanket exclusion for under 16. And it was then thought, well, retain the blanket exclusion for under 16 and make it very clear that this is in fact applicable to between 16 and 18 years. And then at some stage there was the idea developed of make a concession that it doesn't make it applicable to all.
So you exclude
That part 4 was excluded. I do not think that much turns on it, and it's probably correct the way that it is now, but just to explain why B has simply been repealed and everything then restated.
But you see, then you still lose the, I think, quite vital aspect, which says that if you are going to prefer the minimum sentences, we expect you to write down what that you found no substantial. That, you see, the intention behind that was precisely, it runs counter to what was found in Brandt and in the Blouse case, that being a young offender in and of itself is certainly grounds to be considered as substantial and compelling circumstances. And that's really what it was meant to convey to the court. If you take that away, then you're getting closer to the suggestion I want to refer that. You're getting closer to the suggestion that, in fact, the onus lies with the accused, who is a young offender, to prove that his youthfulness should be a substantial and compelling circumstance, rather than it being something that the court should mere mutu consider. And that's really what we're trying to say there. The other way to do it, of course, is to, when you deal with the 3AA, it's the other way to say, in these instances where there is a person who is young, the court should consider the fact as part of the circumstances pertaining to substantial and compelling circumstances. I mean, you don't want to necessarily, well, I don't know that you don't want to do it given the kind of interpretations that have followed. But it's certainly an option to look at.
As the law stands at the moment, and let's ignore Brandt, the idea was that you must impose the minimum sentence unless you find substantial compelling circumstances, in which case you must record that on the record.
Correct.
Explain.
Correct.
But if you impose it on a person between 16 and 18, it goes to the minimum sentence, unless you find compelling circumstances, those compelling circumstances. But if you do impose the minimum sentence, you must also then indicate on the record why you did not find substantial income. Now, there could be an argument, and this is more from an academic perspective, that's not very elegant done in law. It's really rather unnecessary, but that's what it boils down to. And that is probably because of that style of legislating, that the word decide was, for example, used, which led to the misinterpretation. So it is quite possible to redraft that existing provision to leave out the site simply by stating when a court imposes a minimum sentence on a person in Section 18, it must the court why it came to the conclusion that it was not compelling and substantial circumstances. That's probably the safer route to go.
I must say that I like that more and more, because when I read this thing about what my question says, it says the court suggested that the court would readily conclude that the use of an offender between 16 and 18 was in itself a substantial and compelling sentence. I mean, that's the approach that we'd wanted. What they then do and say in the other case is they say, well, no, that's not what happened. In fact, what happens is that there's no difference between an adult and a person between 18 and 16, because there the onus is on the accused to prove substantial and compelling circumstances exist. And surely this is an onus that is rather huge for a young person to bear in mind. Now, clearly that's wrong. That's not the approach that we had allowed. And it seems to me that you're right, Mr. DeLonge, that we should perhaps look at different ways to make clear that intention. And so I'd be happy if you were to give us some options in that regard as well.
We'll do that, Jan. Then just with respect, one observation, I think we must just be careful that youth on itself can never be a substantial and compelling circumstance. If the legislature wanted that to be the case, it would have given a blanket exclusion. So what we've done is make a concession. It might be a factor. It's unlikely, but in itself, it will never be a substantial and compelling.
Yeah. No, it's precisely what was being said by Professor Blanche and, of course, the Malthus situation, where they were saying that if you take all of the factors into account, and then you have to make an assessment, excluding personal preferences, excluding the fact that you don't like the minimum sentence legislation, excluding any personal perspectives and inherent biases you may have, both for and against the offender, when you then take these matters into account, and then you have to consider those elements. And one of those elements must necessarily be the age of the person standing in front of you. That's really what we're saying. I mean, you can't sit there as a court and find a 16-year-old in front of you and say that the onus is on him to show where they're in fact. I mean, that's just nonsensical. It's just, how can that ever be just?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And then if I may be allowed just to go a bit back a little bit on the exclusion of the grounds, personal circumstances relationship that when it comes to the sense of rape. I just want to refresh the committee's memory a little bit, because it might be of some use. In 2006, last year, at the budget hearings, when the Chief Justice and the President of the Supreme Court of Appeal made their presentations to the committee, Ms. Johnson, in fact, raised this very issue, and she referred to the case where the youth of an accused was taken into account, combined with the fact that he was still at school and a very virile young person. And I think that is the challenge that's facing you as to, and if you read, and I only refresh my memory from the minutes of DMG, so I can't recall everything that was said, but I think the dilemma facing the committee and from the legislative perspective is there was basically a confession from the judiciary that it was conceded, that it was a very serious misdirection from the judge. But what can they do to remedy it? If they cannot do something to remedy it, then obviously it falls to you. And I think that's where the compromise and the challenge lies to. How far you would want to go, with reference to what Dr. Delport said earlier as well, as what do you leave to the courts, and what can the courts do, and what can you do?
The best you can do under those circumstances, Mr. DeLong, and of course others have raised this issue, is you cannot, as a legislature, never legislate for every specific circumstance. You can't do it, you shouldn't do it, it's just bad practice. But what you can do is you can guide and you can send messages in the legislation so that when particular circumstances arise, hopefully judicial officers find guidance in what, because a lot of the time the inquiry is what was the intention of the legislature. And if you are silent on things and you know that the courts have interpreted things in a particular way, then you seem to be acquiescing. That is correct, that is correct. And if you want to send a message as a lady, you do it in the law. And the law is not capable of being specific enough to deal with every single instance that arises. And this is why I'm very much in favor of saying things like, this cannot solely be a substantial and compelling circumstance. Why? Because, and not going to, it's not, you know, if somebody wants to take it into account, it's going to take it into account. That's not going to stop them from doing so. They'll just have to find one or two other things on the table, taken as a whole, this is going to be a substantial circumstance. But the worst of it is that the legislature is saying that we feel profoundly strongly that you can't have a situation where a father who fosters a child, raises that child, is given a lesser sentence because there is a relationship and that this person isn't therefore of any danger to society because he kept it in the family. You know, I think that those are the kinds of things that we as a legislature, I think is appropriate to convey to the judiciary, bearing in mind what Dr. Delport and others have been saying, that sometimes the relationship is indeed a substantial and compelling factor. For example, that there's a breadwinner situation, that the family will be destitute, that the circumstances surrounding the incident are such that it's mitigating in some respects. Under those circumstances, clearly what you want to do is you don't want to exclude the discretion of the judicial officer to such an extent that there's an absolute bar and there's an absolute prohibition from taking those circumstances into account. But at the same time, guiding them and saying that when it comes to certain perverse conclusions, that those certainly are not matters that we think ordinarily that the court should determine constitute substantial and compelling circumstances that are in any way justified.
Just to add to what you said, when those cases that we looked at last year, I mean, it saddens us, I think, as a committee, but there are, unfortunately, judges and judicial officers on our benches who, in this day and age, say that if a complainant had a relationship with the accuser or was married to the accuser, that it's not that bad. And I think to avoid those scenarios from happening, there is a duty on the legislature to say, we find it as appalling and it is a crime and it's to guide us. And I think we have a duty as a committee to send that message.
But we look at the final draft that you produce and so on, and we'll certainly, I mean, this is not a discussion that we'll close immediately. There may also be other instances that we might want to look at in terms of setting down a list of things over and above the three that we've got there currently. You remember that the Tswana Ring people came and said that in some instances they found evidence where if the person was employed or unemployed, this constituted justification for a lesser sentence. Now, they said they would substantiate those things in a citrus input, and when we get that, we may want to consider what else we should record there and so on. But first, let's have a look at the wording with just these three factors, and we'll then also see if that's a closed list. Okay, where are we now?
We're now finished with clause one. We're moving to clause two.
Ah.
Clause two deals with the repeal of the referral process. So only two submissions which have dealt with this clause. First one is from ARMSA. ARMSA supports the repeal of these sections. But a lot of the other submissions, of course, said they supported the repeal of the referral process. So it wasn't noted here. Basil King has a rather longer argument on this point. I'm going to read it. It is submitted that without a referral being at all possible, some offenders may still receive inadequate punishment. It is that argument basically, again, that we've heard already, where they now can't refer anymore for a higher sentence and then they have to revert to back to their own jurisdiction. It is therefore submitted that since the bill contains certain provisions amending the Criminal Procedure Act, it also further amends section 114 or 116. Which relates to referral from district courts, or insert new provisions in chapters 17 and 18 to cater for a referral from a regional court to a high court, not only to provide machinery for any such case, but also in the promotion of independence. That is, that the judiciary makes the final decision as to the proper punishment and not the prosecution service. Or it is submitted that the bill should contain a provision allowing a regional court to commit the accused for sentence by a high court in similar circumstances, to the original section 52.1, if the regional court is of the opinion that the offense concerned warrants punishment in excess of its jurisdiction.
Excess of its jurisdiction
is 52.1.
Yeah,
the
15 years, sorry, and
it's
part one.
So he's concerned.
But we did say to you that we wanted you to drop the proviso, which is that if they think life is unsuitable, but certainly a more substantive 15 years, that they're able to do that. So that you've got instruction on. Mm-hmm. Are we giving you
instruction? Yes. And the issue also here is that if prosecuting service really sees that there's a problem, they can still make use of the precursory examination, stop the proceedings, and then take it to the high court.
The member theory is the longer way to well.
Okay, there's a further issue. It's also sometimes I suppose you can't say funny, but it's interesting how since the coming into existence of this act, this is now perceived as a problem because we're intending to repeal the transfer procedure. But before 1998 there was no transfer procedure. Why is this all of a sudden such a train smash now?
Mm.
We've in fact given regional courts increased jurisdiction to deal with those offences, but now this is a perceived train smash. I'm not saying he's wrong. In fact, he makes a point. He makes a very good point in his submission as well as to how there could possibly be an injustice when a person rapes a third victim aged of a certain age and it becomes a part one. Right, and when the person aged rapes a victim that's 2 or 3 months older and it's part 3, right? So these possibilities do exist. But I think it's wrong to say that as a result of the fact all these justices, all of us injustice all of a sudden now may occur. Can always be addressed in terms of the existing provisions and procedures, albeit maybe sometimes
the committal procedure in terms of staying with the prosecution and then converting it to an inquiry, I mean, that's your chapter 17 and 18 that he's referring to.
I'm not sure which provisions they are exactly. I think Dr. Lowe might have been here. He's referring to 114 and 116 of the Home Procedure Act.
Now, that's your district court.
District regional court.
But that's not serious because you don't
exactly,
really want to.
Exactly, but the other provision relates to the prosecution discovering at some time during the trial that matter is actually more serious, and they convert the whole proceeding thing into what they call a provisional inquiry. I mean, but it's very unlikely, and like I said, that provision has always been there long before this minimum sentence, which only came into operation in 1998. And if a problem exists now, it must have existed then. And the camp is shut itself out.
I'm I'm not quite sure that I follow that argument, 17 and 18, to be honest. To cater for referral from a regions and high court, not only to provide machinery for any such case, but also in the promotion of independence. That is, the judiciary makes the final decision as to the proper punishment and not. But I guess he's also commenting in the absence of this provision that you're now going to drop.
I think the dependent is referring to is arguing that the mere fact that the prosecution is instituting the regional court is really an indication from the prosecution service as to how they view the punishment. But that also, I mean, that's always been the fact. That always been coming like long before this legislation.
No, but that's why you would increase the regional court's jurisdiction as well, so that you don't just have this understanding that if you prosecute at your regional court, it must be a lesser crime.
Yes.
I mean, that's not what we're doing. If they prosecute at the regional court, it can be an equally serious crime as it is now.
But we must remember that before the existence of this legislation, that has always been the criteria when the prosecution decided whether to institute in a court of first instance in the High Court or to go to the regional court, with the exception of treason where the High Court has jurisdiction.
Yeah.
But I think
the problem here is in fact that he's doing it in the absence of that, and I think he's quite correct to assume that if the legislation as tabled were to then be promulgated and so on, then you would have that lacuna. And then that would create the impression that when they prosecute at this level, if they don't find life, then you're going to get 15 years. And that's clearly wrong. Okay. So that will be drafted as well. Anybody wants to raise anything at this stage? Okay. Yes? No? Okay.
Subsections 1, 2, and 2A. Subsections 3 and 5 of the further submission play no meaningful role in view of the new transitional process set out in Clause 6 of the Bill and should thus also be repealed. We've looked at 3 and 5 and we were of the view that there might still be cases in the system and it does not do any harm leaving them on the legislative books. So we were not convinced that they had to be deleted.
Which ones are those that
he wants in 53? He wants in the Act. He wants three subclauses, subsection 3 and 5, that were they're also transitional provisions from previous amendments. They wanted them to be deleted as well.
Just refer again, which section?
53?
3
and
5. 53, 3 and 5.
Transitional provisions, yeah, it doesn't do any harm. It would be like a cleaning up exercise if we had to go through everything and delete everything.
Oh, those are the savings for 53, 2, and?
No, 3.
3 and 5.
We just recommended that why don't we delete them as well? We were of opinion we'd rather use them on the legislation at this stage.
Okay. It doesn't do any harm because in any case there was a transitional provision during that time. 5, what is 5? That's convicted. Of course, that's 5 is convicted. I'm going to be accused of sentence.
It refers way back to the Judicial Matters Amendment Act of 2000, and I don't believe there were court cases where that was actually executed. Okay. Then the second point, clause 6, which is the, who actually sort of comes to that, but he made the point here in reference to 53, clause 6, which is our transitional provision in this bill, should affect an amendment to the Act so that the transitional provision is not left standing in some other Act. Section 53 was submitted should rather reflect the transitional process. We initially have the transitional provision here in 53, and then on advice of the state law advisors, we've moved it into the bill. So
6 should affect an amendment to the Act so that the transitional provision is not left standing in some other Act. Section 53, it was submitted, should rather reflect the transitional process.
So the argument is basically now the transitional provision is in the bill, but we would have liked to have seen it in 53, which deals with transitional provisions.
Oh, I see.
That's so where we added when we drafted, but then on advice of the state law.
So where is it going to be now?
It's now going to be in the bill, and if we pass the bill.
It will be in the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 2007 as opposed to the Criminal Law Act of 1998. That's 1998. Bearing in mind, keeping those other transitional provisions there. You're going to define herd. What does it mean?
No, we're going to come, there's a whole lot of
sub-issues
on that.
Okay. I suppose at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter where it is as long as it's there.
I think the point you're making is more a matter of convenience than anything else. If you want to discover what the law states look at this Criminal Law Amendment Act, and you tend to forget that there might be an amendment act with only one substantive clause, which would be the transitional provision.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
You want that? I mean, you don't really want that either. Why don't you put it back in that other thing? Put it back in the what you've got savings clause. But it's not. I want to be above the corner. So you were going to do it as a 54?
Yeah, we were going to do it as 53 plus. I don't remember yet. We added the yards and had 600.
But all of these transitional provisions that you've got under 53 now have basically served their purpose. Is that right?
Yes.
But you still want to keep them. But the other thing you could do is just replace it.
Yeah, one could do that, Chair. It's really also a matter of legal certainty. I cannot, for example, say that none of these appeals are not still pending. And if they are still pending or anything is left to be decided, those judges will have to revert to the tax. And it's rather annoying if you revert back and say, but I'm now dealing with a provision that's been appealed. That will cause them to go back to those
three. But then what you do is, the version that I've got of the Act says 53.3 saving. Why is that? What is the savings clause? Is it 53 or is it 53.3?
No, 53 savings clause.
Okay. Then what you do is, and then you've got a sub 1, sub 2.
Sub 3, sub 4, sub 5.
That's 3, there we go.
Can't we make it 53.1? And then you've got sub. We don't number it like that, then you've got A, B, C after that. What I'm trying to do is to separate and not make it a sum of 53, if you know what I'm saying. How would you do that in terms of your numbering? Would you...
Maybe if you want to put it in the principal act, then it's probably best to put a 53 capital A.
Do it that way.
Then the rest of the submissions on Clause 3 are basically opposed to Clause 3 because they're opposed to repealing the every second year renewal process. But the first group here is the South African Human Rights Commission. The Commission does not support the removal of the provision that allows for minimum sentencing to be extended every 2 years. The Commission submitted in this regard that it would prefer for minimum sentence to be done away with and for the appeals based on appropriate sentencing frameworks in South Africa. Can I read all of them that deal with the same topic, maybe, because they're all against basically they make
sentencing
the
same
point, yes. The Open Society Foundation does not support the repeal submitted by Parliament, essentially hereby entrenching minimum sentences in our law as permanent feature, and that they supported the development of a comprehensive and coherent sentencing framework. CSVR again said it should be retained for a fixed period for the retention of this legislation. It should be stipulated whilst review of the current system and a redrafting of a new comprehensive sentencing framework is undertaken. Professor Sir Blanche submitted that making this legislation permanent will readily result in a reassessment of the situation, and the legislation might well not survive another constitutional challenge, and submitted that 51312 should remain in place. CSBRI says the deletion is premature, further dialogue is required on sentencing reform, and lastly, the Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference submitted that removing it from the effective oversight of Parliament is a retrograde step and an admission of defeat in the fight against crime.
What is 53.1 from the effective oversight?
It's the renewal process that it has to come.
Okay.
Every 2 years.
I don't understand what's happening. In any case, Parliament doesn't engage this on this matter. What happens is that the President says that he will want to renew it, and he asks whether Parliament concurs. And then we usually do it by agreement with the parties. We don't have hearings about it. That's how it's usually done. We challenge him whether we agree or not. Yeah. He tells us what he wants, and then we tell him what he wants. Yeah, I think that's quite right. Now look, I think that there are a few issues here. The first is that issue that suddenly we will stop reviewing this matter. So, and I think that that's clearly not right. I mean, the issue is ultimately there is the matter of the sentencing framework has been formally now referred back to the Law Commission to deal with some of these cases that have subsequently happened in the Constitutional Court, where it's quite clear that the executive and the legislature has a role to play in sentencing. That's what the Constitutional Court says. But if you look at the option provided by the Law Commission, it doesn't allow for the legislature or the executive to have any role in regards to that. And then what's more disturbing for me, of course, is that a number of people have submitted that a sentencing framework is going to lead to certain certainties and so on. The problem is with the option that was submitted, those of you who have read the Law Commission's proposal, is that it allows for complete discretion as to whether the framework is actually applied by judicial officers. I mean, there isn't a framework, ultimately. So there's no real substance to what is currently being preferred by the Law Commission, and I believe that the department, I had a chat with Mr. Radman, who pointed out some of these deficiencies, and apparently the minister has now referred some of these concerns back to the Law Commission and asked them to consider some of these matters, particularly the issues raised in the Constitutional Court as it pertains to some of these matters. So it's not as if this matter is being abandoned suddenly by us taking away the two-year extension and so on. Secondly, you know, I don't understand why people seem to think that the sentencing framework cannot exist with mandatory sentences in certain crimes. I mean, it does in other countries. You have a sentencing framework and you have mandatory sentences in certain crimes. So why it is that suddenly there's this assumption that the one can't exist without the other and so on, I'm not quite sure. Then the third issue of, which is what Professor Ted Blanche raises, which is by making the legislation permanent in and of itself could produce a constitutional challenge which would make this legislation unconstitutional. I have never heard anywhere that is necessarily a factor in whether a bill is constitutional or not, is its temporary nature, or that Parliament must review it every other day or whatever it is. I mean, the truth of the matter is Parliament can at any stage repeal this legislation. The fact that we're making it a permanent feature and that you don't need to review it every 2 years, because frankly it's been a nightmare to do it in terms of procedure and so on. Sometimes we are recent. I remember the last time that we did it, and even this time around, it was a helter-skelter because nobody's keeping tabs on these things. It was the presidency, and then suddenly somebody wakes up and says, oh, you know, we better renew this, and then Parliament's on recess or something of that sort, and it's difficult to then get a resolution of the House. And nothing really prevents, as I say, nothing ever prevents Parliament from repealing or amending any law. So on what basis will that be found to be unconstitutional? I'm not sure. But look, those are all of the comments. Anybody wants to say something? Anybody wants to offer different views to what I'm saying? Please feel free at this stage. Mr. Swart, Mr. Dr. Delford, particularly Emma.
I mean, there are a number of substitutes you're mentioning, this, you know, comprehensive sentencing framework.
Yeah.
I really know what they mean by that. I mean, if I understand in a small way, a framework, if they do understand by framework, they mean what we're doing within sentences, then I don't see any difference there anyway. If they mean by a framework, it's policy. I need to understand that there is some policy, some sort of banana. There is a framework as far as overall as I can see, because this is being done in conjunction, you know, with what is being determined by, well, particularly the High Court, for example. There is some framework. I need to understand this concept. I need to understand what it means. It's very easy to. Somebody can explain it, I appreciate it.
Look, I think that they are differences in the understanding of what a sentencing framework can be. And I think you're right to raise the fact that there is probably not a single model. But I think what the benefit of having a sentencing framework, and now remember that there, what is being proposed is not necessarily what I'm saying now, but I mean, from my perspective, what I envisage is that you would have a sense of the possible range of sentences pertaining to each major crime.
Pardon?
No, well, they've got, the details have to be worked out, but in terms of the, that's what I'm saying, it's not what necessarily the Law Commission is proposing. What they're proposing is what they call a sentencing council that will determine these broad parameters. But as I say, the whole point of a sentencing framework is to engender certainty so that like cases get sentenced by and large in the same way, and that there's some consistency across the board. Now, particularly for our context, I think it has its advantages, given our history, given our background, given the kind of things that you saw about the racialization of sentences when those people from, where was it? The people who did the, yeah, that's funny name. But you saw there that they were trying to show us how certain racial groups, for example, are more prone to be sentenced than other racial groups and so on. So clearly, from our perspective and our history and given where we come from, a sentencing regime of some sort with the necessary discretions applying would be, I think, rather useful in the execution of justice. And the way that we understood, or certainly that I understood, but this was very preliminary in the discussions, it certainly is not what is there currently in the recommendation, but that you would have an upper and a lower limit attached to each crime, and that the discretion of the judiciary will be between those limits. So if, for example, for robbery you can get, let's say, 7 to 14 years, then the discretion would be between the lower limit of 7 and the upper limit of 14. But at least there'll be some degree of certainty, because you're not going to get somebody who's killed 4 people and maimed another 10 who's going to get a fine. So that's how I understood it. But it seems that what has happened now is that the Law Commission is proposing these things, but also a general proviso to say that if the judiciary feels like it, they can not apply. And then they've added in the upper and lower limits substantial and compelling circumstances. So over and above the fact that there's a general discretion to say, well, we don't apply the framework, then even if you want to apply the framework, then you can have substantial and compelling circumstances and deviate from the framework, which isn't a framework. It's not going to create any consistency. It's not going to create any certainty. So, and I think this is going to be part of a very important debate that must happen when it comes to what the Law Commission is going to propose. As I understand it, Mr. Trusman says to me that they've now asked the Law Commission to give them a variety of options and not just prefer one option, which is really, I think, the way to go, so that ultimately the whole range of options on the table, and that we can, based on what we think is the most important criteria for ourselves in our situation, actually decide on which model we then want to prefer above another. And this is going to take some time. I mean, you must remember in those countries, in some states in the United States, where they have comprehensive sentencing regimes. I mean, you see it often in the movies where you know that somebody who's charged with this is facing 10 to 15. And that's the range. But those things take a number of years to develop. They don't just, it's not just a question of saying, oh, okay, let's pick a number. It takes years and years and years to develop, and particularly for every single client, if you're going to have that kind of regime, it's going to take a hell of a long time to determine. But it's something that must happen, of course, and that certainly I, for one, would be very supportive of such a framework, bearing in mind the things that I'm saying. Because for me, the biggest advantage would be consistency. The biggest advantage. Okay, anybody else? Sorry, Mr. Swart, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. In broad terms, whilst appreciating what Dr. Delport has said about that fine line between the legislature and interfering with the role of the judiciary, I'm very supportive of your sentiments and in broad terms, the approach that we've adopted with these amendments, and particularly in view of media reports and the whole women's month that we have, the issue of sexual offences and the lack of consistency. And I think some of the cases that were pointed out by Carol in our last year's submission, that the judgment of Carol Lewis that I pointed out to you earlier, does indicate that we do need to set firmer guidelines, particularly when it comes to rape. And so with those few comments, I do broadly support your sentiments expressed. Thank you.
Okay, anybody else? Okay, thank you. Let's move on.
Then we move on to Clause 4. Clause 4 deals with the automatic right of appeal. Firstly, AMSA supports Clause 4. Then Basil King. Basil King, and I'm going to read his first submission. It is submitted that further textual amendments be effected at this stage, particularly to what was Section 309.1a sub 3, now to be 309.1aicc. Namely, by rectifying the rather ridiculous situation that currently exists regarding the use of the words any form of imprisonment contemplated in Section 2761. The problem, it was submitted with this phrase, is that an accused person under the age of 21 years who is sent to a reform school by a district or regional court has to apply for leave to appeal, as imprisonment contemplated in Section 2761 excludes a referral to a reform school made in terms of Section 291D, although the matter is subject to automatic review. So this is a completely different point that he brings in here. And yeah, it might be we need to consult further on this and whether this is the place or whether it should go into judicial matters if it's really necessary.
I think you must look at it and then see if I don't know who's compiling a judicial matter at the moment. See whether in fact they do that one too. Yeah. Maybe just draw his attention to it and ask them to have a look at it.
Then his second submission in this regard is further submitted that a sentence of life imprisonment should be automatically reviewable. So he, by a judge of the provincial or local division having jurisdiction, and that an appropriate amendment in this regard should be made to Section 302 of the CPA. So he's basically arguing for automatic review instead of automatic review, which the committee has debated earlier.
Yeah, as I said, the problem with the review is that it's not really the section. Maybe an easier procedure in terms of the number of judicial officers that you may require in an appeal being two and maybe just one. But that doesn't deal adequately enough, I think, with the concerns around the preferring of a life sentence and then creating a safety net for somebody to inquire into whether in fact substantial and compelling circumstances exist in a particular case to deviate from the minimum sentence. And that's not something that can be inquired under a review, I don't think. Yeah, unless anybody wants to, because remember the prosecuting authority also raised this matter. I don't know if anybody has a counter view. I'll be happy to go with the appeal procedure because that is the safety net. If you're going to allow regional courts to sentence to life under the circumstances, then you would want to ensure that there is a safety net. And to do it by way of review is not going to allow for an adequate, I think, inquiry into whether substantial or compelling circumstances exist. Because remember, reviews are procedural in nature and not, they don't inquire into the substance of the matter.
next commissioner from the Center for the Study of Violence Reconciliation, and they basically make the argument that's also been mooted already, where they say that doing away with the referral procedure and now giving automatic right of appeal will still lead to case backlogs in the High Court. So they say increased. And they say there will be other problems, such as the accused person should have access to legal assistance, which is not always available.
Okay, I think we've discussed these elements. The fact that hopefully there won't be as many cases as people seem to assume based on structures and policies. And that secondly, in any case, an important provision to have because it provides an adequate safety in case things go wrong, for example. Cool. Members, anybody want to raise anything?
Will deal with it as any other criminal matter in which they're constitutionally obliged to intervene once you've done their means checking and everything else. And I'm not sure that there's a clause in this act.
No,
provisions that require the court to leave here and that people were thinking to be assessed, that's possibly right.
Okay. I can just then also make the point that the Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference makes exactly the same point as CSVR if we stick on that argument. Then if I return to the Child Justice Alliance, they have a different argument around Clause 4. They welcome the amendments made to the ages of children in this amendment. They requested that it should be amended further to provide that all children are provided with an automatic right of appeal.
Regardless of whether it's minimum 10 years or not.
So they make a wider position. Clause 5 deals with the prosecuting policy of the NPA. UNSA supports Clause 5, then Basil King. It is submitted that whilst the directive may be clear in its terms, the possibility of a serious case slipping through merely because the investigation is not complete or adequate or covers aspects that may be necessary for determination of the forum may result in an offender escaping proper justice. This argument should be read in like the previous one he made earlier where he's actually against the referral process being done away with and that he's afraid that the regional court won't have high enough jurisdiction.
And now we're addressing that problem.
Yeah. So he submits the only safe solution is to make provision for a referral in appropriate cases. You know, so he's exactly agreeing to the previous argument. Firstly, the NPA submits that it poses a question as to what criteria could be used to determine which of the relevant cases must still be tried in the High Court if the regional court has jurisdiction to impose life sentences, notwithstanding the seriousness or complexity of a case.
The India has further submitted in this regard that directly the seriousness or complexity of the case of factors would be inconsistent with the paramount principles contained in the bill, namely to provide the regional courts the same penal jurisdiction as the High Court. Similarly, the MPA submitted that to direct that high-profile or controversial cases must be tried in the High Court would be inconsistent with the constitutional right that everyone is equal before the law.
The cases in Part 1, particularly, and with the proviso that the Special Offences Court would still be used for those crimes in Part 1 where necessary or where appropriate, which would be most of the time, I guess. And then as far as well, actually the same thing would apply to the other parts as well. Because there you have rating and three. Racing, then it should go there. But we'll formulate.
I think they also sort of answered their own questionnaire in the oral hearings where they suggested that maybe this committee could just make it clear that if a case is then instituted in the regional court and with the facts becoming more clear, it seems that it should have gone to the High Court according to their policies, that it should proceed in the regional court. And that's why the whole clause 5 is there basically to cater for if they institute in the High Court in the first instance in these cases and then those that fall through the cracks continue.
So one thing we can't do is to set out in legislation what their processes and policies should be. And what we're doing is we're empowering it. I think that what we'll need to do at some stage is to look at solution and an amendment. We don't really have an object clause. What is this part here called? It's like the long title. Maybe we can say something there. We say already that we're getting rid of the transfer. Have you given some thought to their proposal that somewhere in the legislation that we make clear our intention that the prosecuting policy should be aimed at, broadly speaking, prosecution of the most serious offences at your High Court? And that the prosecuting policy should then deal with matters relating to such, or prosecuting policy should deal with the matter of serious offences being charged at a regional court under certain something of that nature.
Yeah, I'm not very, very much in favour of that sort of approach, because then by implication we admit that we do not have full confidence in our regional courts. We may not have that confidence, but Parliament cannot by implication admit that we don't want very serious, high profile or whatever to go to the regional court. Of course, I do not understand the NPA's questions here, or rather the caveats, because nowhere we are saying that it should be formulated in a particular particular way. It's up to the NPA, from a practical point of view, to decide what cases will be sent. Maybe they want to say very long cases where there are many witnesses. We would rather send here or there. But the moment the two courts have the same jurisdiction in terms of sentence, we cannot, by implication, say, but if it's a difficult case, we would rather entrust it to the Supreme Court, or to the regional court for that matter. When I was a, what can you say, 50 years ago, a prosecutor on the Attorney General's staff, we used to refer, as a matter of course, rather serious manslaughter cases to the regional court than to the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court at the time was known, having drafted the judges from, mostly from defense counsel, and magistrates drafted mostly from the prosecuting staff. We felt that the more serious, or a more serious approach to sentencing, we found in the regional court. So it's a question where the prosecuting staff, the prosecuting authority, must judge. And I don't think we must interfere or give guidelines.
Now, I hear you, Dr. Delbert. The only problem was that, of course, if you look at their first comment there, it seems almost as if they're asking us to give some sense of what would be the determining criteria to go. In other words, if you're going to have an automatic appeal in a Part 1 matter, and you have a murder case, for example, would you prosecute it at the regional court as first instance and another case at the high court? Or should they actually be... And I hear what you're saying, that we shouldn't be the ones determining it. That's not for us to determine. But I think that they anticipate some difficulty, as they have on a consistent basis from JPs who refuse to entertain cases in their courts. And so they would want some sense that the legislature did intend for them to approach this matter in a particular way as opposed to a different way.
Jay, your problem with indicating criteria up front is that, first of all, let's take the question of appeal. Appeals arise out of admissibility of evidence, or evidence that was inadmissible, being admitted, whatever. You can never up front tell where the appeal may come from. It's not merely on the sentence itself, or finding this or that. Secondly, the seriousness of the case will more often than not only come to light or finally be confirmed. It may look very serious, and then at the trial, by reason of the facts put forward by the defense, it may turn out not to be that serious. So you can never up front judge how serious, whether there's a chance for appeal. I think it's more a question of practical. The criteria must be very practical. What is the court load at present in the Supreme Court vis-a-vis the regional court? Where can you get the quicker? How long do you need? Do you have a Supreme Court that would be 20 witnesses to be listened to be called? Whether you have a Supreme Court ready that can sit, a judge that can sit for 10, 20, or a month, or whatever, I think it's practical criteria, practical persuasion.
I'm very persuaded by that argument, Dr. Delport. I think you give us some sense of how they might approach things. But also it comes down to, particularly in this instance, in other words, when it comes to these crimes, you're not just talking about general crimes. You're talking about these specific matters. And in these specific matters,
remember, when we draft this, we're always mindful of the fact that we had wanted the more serious crimes to be prosecuted in this. That's always been the problem with this committee and the problem that we've had with the NPA as well. I mean, when they first broached the subject with us of double jeopardy, I mean, secondary trauma, not double jeopardy. Secondary trauma. It could be double jeopardy too. our response to them, you would recall, was, well, then why don't you prosecute in the High Court to begin with? I mean, if the High Court's requiring evidence to be led and so on and so on. And then the response was, well, you know, we can't because the JPs won't allow it. Now, clearly what we intend by this is that that should be the case for part one and for certainly. Because ultimately you want your higher courts that have inherent jurisdiction to prefer the law. The extension of the jurisdiction in the regional courts would be for those matters where you point out that it's not apparent up front in your docket, whether this is a serious, less serious, or whatever matter. And if it happens that it turns out to be a part one matter and you've already started prosecuting at your regional court, then you don't want necessarily to stay proceedings in transfer because you want to get rid of that transfer process. And you then want to prefer the jurisdiction and have that safety net in place as well. Having said that, of course, you still have your sexual offences court, where in every instance or most instances you're going to prosecute at your regional court because you have specialized facilities there in those particular instances. But notwithstanding that, they may, for example, want to uplift some rape cases and deal with them in the High Court because of the seriousness of the matters. And in fact, in some instances where witnesses don't need the special facilities such as a CCTV and so on, that may then go to the High Court to avoid the automatic appeal and so on. So, I mean, my sense is that is certainly what I have in mind as far as the policy is concerned. And the real issue is, are we able to communicate that? And I guess we'll do that in our parliamentary speeches, and we'll do that maybe even in a report. So there's an idea, a report. Interesting. Maybe we'll consider a report. That will at least be something. And then not in legislation, you do it more as an intent. Message to the executive, can then convey it to the prosecution authority. What do you think about that? Yeah? Okay. Okay. NPA submitted that if the portfolio committee approves the principle to grant the regional court jurisdiction to impose life, the NPA would undertake to issue policy directives to ensure that cases are tried in the High Court and courts of first instance, where the facts are such that it would, in the opinion, warrant the imposition of life. Where such matters are apparent, I think that would be adequate.
When they cover their next point, why this seems to be contravening it is because it was much later in their submission that they then say they did not support this amendment, stated that the NPA is of the view that it's not desirable to include this provision in the Act. This, I think it relates to their point one, that they're not sure of how to test the criteria. And then they make a technical suggestion that they will take on board.
I think it's correct that we can't in legislation say what the policy directives must be and mustn't be. I don't even know if that is on all fours. It's a question of separation of powers as well. What this clause is an empowering clause. I mean, the truth of the matter is you don't even need it because they can. They can issue policy directives, but what you're doing now is you're going to give it the force of law by empowering them to do so, specifically in regard to the matters. And there they're then able to say that if matters are apparently Part 1 matters, we will then proceed in the High Court. And then you say, accept. And then, under those circumstances, the High Court will have to reciprocate in terms of accommodating the prosecution. Really, so I don't think we can go in. I think Dr. Dalcourt is quite correct when he says that we shouldn't in legislation determine, even guidelines, what prosecuting authorities' policy is, because that in itself could be a challenge. So those are the points.
Then the technical point I make is that we use the word prosecution policy, and it must be prosecuted. They say that according to the words used, there is a clear distinction made in the Constitution between policy directives and prosecution policy. And that what we're talking about here is policy directives.
Directives flow from a policy. In other words, the directives are the issuing of instructions to your ordinary prosecutors who are prosecuting at your court. But those directives clearly have to comply with a policy. Don't look at it now. Just flag it, Dr. Lowe, at this stage. But it seems to me that what we're doing is we're asking them to do policy so that they can then issue directives under that policy, if you wish.
The
problem is that if you have directives without a policy in place, then those directives can be challenged in the same thing. They don't seem to have a grounding or a base. Okay. So that's my impression of it, but you can correct me once you've had a look at it. Let's go to Arnsa.
Yes, then there's two opposing views, because then you have to look at Arnsa and the MPA. This deals with how to deal with transitional positions. Arnsa seems to make an argument to the one side and the MPA to the other side, so I thought maybe it's good to look at both, and Arnsa even gave us a follow-up email in this regard as well, that they feel strongly against the MPA's proposal. So this is not even looking at what's in the bill currently, they both have their own suggestions. But maybe if I can read them quickly, then Arnsa submitted that these near referrals could take months to finalize, since these cases will have to be placed on the roll of the High Court in order for them to be referred back. And therefore, they submitted that in order to speed up the finalization of these cases in the transitional phase, the legislation must allow the regional court to maintain jurisdiction over those cases referred to the High Court, which have not yet been heard by it. The regional court can then simply proceed with the matter as soon as possible without the delay of referral. ARMSA proposed the following section to be substituted for Clause 6. And it reads as follows: if a regional court has, prior to the commencement of the Act, committed an accused for sentence by a High Court under the Criminal Amendment Act of 1997, and the case has not been allocated a court date in the High Court prior to the date of the commencing of this Act, then the regional court will have jurisdiction to impose sentence as prescribed in this Act, as if the accused was never committed for sentence by a High Court. And then in B, the case has been allocated to the court date prior to the date of the commencing of this Act, then the High Court must, on the allocated or any earliest possible date, refer the matter back to the regional court for sentencing.
and C, the High Court has heard the matter prior to the date of the commencing of this act, or it was on the court rule on a date prior to it, then the High Court must dispose of the matter as if the act has not been passed. If I can read in addition to that their email that they gave here with some practicalities, I'm going to have to translate this in Afrikaans. They say after they found some an accused guilty of a Part 1 offense, they would stop the proceedings and they would refer the case to the High Court. But the records of the case will then be sent for the transcription. But the case actually stays on their roll. And the accused is then told of another date to again appear in the regional court to be told when this case will go to the High Court. And then it says on a date in future, awaiting this trial date to be placed in the High Court, if the accused is in the holding cell, if he's being held in a correctional facility, he would be told of a date that he would have to appear again in the regional court. And he says at this stage, such a case can many times be postponed. And the case for that whole time stays in the regional court or with the regional court jurisdiction in any case. Only once the date has been set will the accused be informed of what date he would then have to appear in the High Court. And it's only from that stage that the case is removed from the regional court's role. And the date that is then obtained is usually a few months away from the last date that they appeared in the regional court.
I see. So that's why they turn it on the allocation of a court date in the High Court as opposed to heard and not heard and so on.
Yes, so they recommend that until there's been a date given on the, and or yeah, the case has been physically put on the roll of the High Court, that only those cases would then proceed in the High Court. But that procedure of the interim period should stay with the regional court, and they should then just go ahead with it. And they said that would also save a lot of costs with all the transcribing that's currently being done.
But would a case receive a court date from their submission there with you now? Would it receive a court date if the records haven't been submitted?
It seems that they in any case send it off for transcription.
So what I'm saying is, does the date in the High Court, is it dependent on the High Court receiving records? Because clearly it seems to me that would be the practical effect of it, that the High Court would not give a date until they had records submitted. In other words, they had the file, or a file, and that file would have to include a record.
Yes, it also depends on the availability of the judge and the court ruling.
Because, you see, if that's the case, if what I'm saying is the case, that the date in the High Court can only be set if the High Court is in receipt of the record, of the trial record, so to speak, then it seems obvious that the High Court should continue with that matter, rather than seeing out going from one role back to the other. But if that isn't the case, if you can get an allocation of a date without the record being transcribed or without them asking for the records to be transcribed, that's a difference. Because then you may then argue and say that the records may not necessarily then be tagged, and then you say costs, and you say this, and you say that. But it does seem to me that if you've got a date, you've waited X amount of time for a date, you've got a date, you've sent your records up, then to ask for that court to send it back is just pointless.
Yes, that's what I gather from them as well here, is that
before a date is allocated within the High Court, the case in any case stays within the Regional Court, and the accused is told to again come to the Regional Court to hear what date he should then go to the High Court.
The first time
so they're saying that once the case is on the High Court roll, they should continue it.
Exactly.
But before that,
before
that,
it seems fine to keep it, and I think it's correct then to, if it's correct, then the only time it gets transferred de facto is once a court date has been allocated by the High Court. Then it makes eminent sense to say that if a court date has not been allocated, then the case must stay in the Regional Court and be finalized in the Regional Court. If a date has been allocated and you've got all those, I mean, you've had numerous postponements and so on in any case, and you then go to the High Court and you've got a date, then clearly it seems to make more sense for the High Court to just then proceed with the matter in the absence of any other submission in that regard. And maybe you want to just call them again and see whether, in fact, I'm correct in my assumption that when a date is allocated, it's only allocated once the High Court receives the record.
Yes, because I also make the point here in the email that says that once a date has been allocated in the High Court and the accused now knows he has to go there, unless he's in custody, it's very difficult to get him back in the Regional Court and would take time. So they're saying once it's there and he knows he has to go there, that
should be there. Although this doesn't say that, it says here in B, the case must be allocated to the case has been allocated a court date prior to the date of commencing of this act, then the High Court must, on the allocated or any possible date, refer the matter back to the Regional Court.
Yeah, I think that's when we reconsider it, and that's when the email came through. But the MPA, maybe we should just quickly look at this before a complete decision is made. The MPA submitted that in the transitional provision, that the transitional provision should be deleted. Instead, they recommended a practical arrangement whereby cases in the High Court should be finalized by the High Court and cases in the Regional Court should be adjourned instead of referred to the High Court for sentencing to be resumed after the law came into effect.
But they can do that anyway.
Yes.
They can stop proceedings at the point of the sentencing at the Regional Court now, wait for this legislation to be implemented, and then let the Regional Court sentence.
And then there are cases where a court date is allocated, that would be a practical thing to work right into the legislation.
So that where there is a date allocated, I mean, it seems to me more onerous to have a situation where it's at the High Court, you've got an allocated date, and then transfer that matter back to the Regional Court, and then you've got to wait for a date here, and get the records transferred here. God knows how many postponements that's going to mean.
And a loss of records in the crisis.
Exactly.
Safety risk as well. But then Basil King also made a submission on clause 6, but he just wanted us to define the word heard. He said there's been a debate as to whether a High Court's been seized with matter, and we now say that it's the date allocated.
And then clearly once the date is allocated, it means that it must proceed. Just also check with the MPA. This thing about the allocation of date and the procedure set out by Adamson. Just make sure that it is practiced in all provinces, so that we don't have a different practice happening in a different province and then we're sitting with the problem. Okay, last submission schedule 2.
Yes, this, and then also an additional submission where Lisa Vetten raised some points in her oral submissions. They also dealt with the schedule, but I'll come to her as well. Okay, ANSA firstly submitted that in order to enhance case flow management in respect of schedule 2 offenses, a section should be included in the bill which obliges the prosecution to provide a summary of facts and a list of state witnesses to the clerk of the court and the defense representatives before the matter is finally done, finally placed for trial in the Regional Court in the case of trials for offenses listed in parts 1, 2, and 3 of Schedule 2.
this very submission already done in the High Court. We felt that this is also a submission that's not really, this is not maybe the role to deal with it, and then further consultation would have to be taken up with the MPA specifically with the implications of such a change. So it didn't go to the heart of this bill. The second point I made, AMSA submitted that the current reference in Part 2 of Schedule 2 of the Act to the possession of a semi-automatic firearm should exclude a semi-automatic pistol. Since the various divisions of the High Court have interpreted Section 51(2) of the Act in such a way that it's now virtually impossible to impose the minimum sentence for such an offense. We also reasoned here that it's not necessary to do it because maybe there's still a reach at the High Court out there that sees a semi-automatic pistol.
And it's dangerous.
Do you think this could cause harm?
No, to leave it there.
People get killed.
And then the third submission. After submitted that rape, other than that, this is the debate we've also had earlier, but yeah, it's moving rape from Part 3 to Part 2.
Yeah.
And then the final submission is in regard to rape in Part 1. It was the oral submission made by Ms. Letton that we didn't follow quite clearly around perpetrator and accomplice and all of that. And she referred us to a case of Ed versus Kimberly, and she said the common purpose of dream does not apply to rape. I went and I read Ed versus Kimberly, and I can give it to the committee as well, and it does not say it at all. It deals with a completely different issue. It does not say that it's not. It basically said that the High Court misinterpreted Part 1 offenses. The Part 1 offenses deals with where somebody's raped more than one time, so that's why it's not raped in Part 3. And this person in this instance, it was specifically to this case, and they didn't say in this case that common purpose does not apply to rape. But I can give the case to the committee.
I think make copies and rape.
Yes, because this case specifically then also deals with the terms accomplices and co-perpetrator. If I could read her submission, it says, in addition to accused, it also refers, this is now Part 1 rape, it also refers to co-perpetrators and accomplices. We recommend doing away with co-perpetrator because there's no such legal concept, as well as deleting accomplice, because accomplices, while they assist in the rape, do not commit the actual rape. If they do not commit actual rape, then they are no longer accomplices, but perpetrators, and should be referred to as such. If you do mean an accomplice in the sense of someone who assists but does not actually rape, then this means that some rapists are being sentenced more leniently than accomplices. She here refers to those in Part 3. But the court didn't actually see it. It's again in Ed versus Kimberly where they go into what the term means specifically, and I don't see a problem with it after reading this case. So basically, her argument would be that rape in Part 3 should be moved up because they're now getting a lesser sentence, or an accomplice is getting a heavier sentence. But it's an accomplice to a specific kind of rape. It's an accomplice to a gang rape, where the person, this is also what happened in Ed versus Kimberly, where the person
holds somebody,
that's exactly what happened in this case. And the court didn't see it that way. They said that for that, you must have lied.
No, that's fine. You can let members look at that, and then if anybody wants to raise this issue again. In any case, we dealt very comprehensively with those kinds of matters in the sexual offences legislation as well, where you have the, it's not just a question of you perpetrating a rape of a crime, and you're an accomplice, or you're assisting somebody to rape.
But I will forward your email to Lolly then to distribute the documents. And the last point, sorry, there was one more thing she said. She was referring to a person who for the third time raped somebody and then falls in Part 3 where he would get 30 years as opposed to somebody who in one instance commits a gang or a multiple rape situation. And she thought, yeah, that there should be, that this person who for the third time committed a rape should also get life.
Well, the courts are free to do that.
Yes. legislation doesn't fit in necessarily if you're prosecuting the issue. Okay. Members, anybody want to raise anything, even generally, make comments generally? Tell me what a good chairperson I am. No. let me just say finally that I've asked Mr. Sibanyone to please, on behalf of us all, to attend Mr. Malasela's funeral, Mr. Malasela's father's funeral on the 11th, and he has very kindly and gracefully acceded to doing that. So thank you very much, Mr. Sibanyone, and please convey our sincere condolences to the family and to Malasela particularly at this very, very trying time. Have you got that resolution? Okay. Well, no, it's fine. I will then look at it separately. I've just been reminded that we are very much core rate. Am I right? How many members do we need? How many do we need?
We need seven.
Seven. We've got seven members. The treaty with Argentina, the mutual cooperation, and the extradition. We haven't voted. We've taken a briefing on it, but we haven't voted on it. So, if somebody wants to say anything about that particular thing, then you're welcome to do so now, because I want to put the question so that we can actually formally adopt those two reports, those two treaties. What is he doing, Berlin? Okay, don't tell us. Okay, so can I then just put the question on both? Must I put them individually? Individually, because they're two treaties. Let's start with the extradition treaty. Those in favor? Okay, seven. Those opposed, those abstaining, none. The other one, the mutual legal assistance. Those in favor? Seven. No abstentions and none against. Okay, thank you very much. I will then find that thing as soon as you okay. Okay, so that's basically our business for today. You realize you're not meeting tomorrow, so that's so exciting. And nobody says I'm a good chairperson, I just don't understand. Then we definitely are not meeting on Friday, so it's a big long holiday for those of you who take holidays. I will be in my office, so if anybody wants to see me, come and see me. And then we will definitely be meeting on Tuesday. How much do we have something on Monday? Did our program end on Monday? You'll hear from me if we are going to sit on Monday. You'll hear from me within the next 24 hours, okay? Whether we're going to sit. The only reason we will sit on Monday is if the select committee is available. Because if they're not available at any other time, I'm going to call you to come on Monday. Tuesday will definitely sit, one way or another, whether they're here, whether we're sitting with Lorette and them with their drafts, or whether we're sitting with the oral hearings and so on, we definitely should be. And so too with Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday next week. Okay? Members of the ANC, if you can just stay behind. I see there's lunch here. Now, this is going to be a bit difficult. So, those of you who want to have your lunch and you are not ANC members, then I suggest what you do is you take your lunch now and go eat it outside, and we will be done in literally 5 minutes, because I just need to to sort a few things out. So please.
Thank you.